animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal. Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Jamie Katz, a Fort Lauderdale-based real-life pet detective. Katz was working as a licensed private investigator about 5 years ago when she began helping a friend look for her missing cat. She became deeply unimpressed with the private investigators her friend had hired. For example, they'd promised to use tracking dogs to locate the animal, but never showed up. This situation struck Katz, a lifelong animal lover and rescuer, in both positive and negative ways, including being intrigued that dogs can help find lost pets. Fast forward a bit and meet her tracking dogs, Fletcher and Gable, part of Katz's thriving full-time pet detective operation. We'll hear about the pet detective business works, in what circumstances she deploys those tracking dogs, and exactly what they do. Some of her recent and or notable cases, what steps we should take if one of our pets goes missing, and more when I speak with Jamie Katz in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll play back the interview I recorded last night with Austin Testa, who created Every Bark Counts, a nonprofit organization whose chief mission is to raise money to help animal shelters, rescues, and sometimes individual animals who are on the cusp of being euthanized. Testa has raised tens of thousands of dollars for this purpose over the years, helping countless animals. This is where I should probably mention that Austin Testa is 12 years old. Right now, though, let's get to my conversation with Jamie about the work of a pet detective, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Jamie Katz on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Jamie.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Oh, you're welcome. I love it.
So, yeah, you were on the show not quite 4 years ago, and I later profiled you in a Washington Post piece, but I don't think we can assume that people listening today heard that earlier show or read the story. So I think we do need to review some fundamental elements of your story that may have at least been important to your becoming a pet detective. Starting, for example, with what role did animals play in your family when you were a kid?
Oh, they were my everything. Animals, just in general, just gave me comfort. That's what made me happy.
So there were animals, obviously, in your family growing up, and you had a strong connection with them, sounds like.
Yes, we had a Great Dane, we had calves, we definitely had some animals in the house. It was awesome.
Why do you think even early on they spoke to you in some way? Because it sounds like there was a pretty profound connection from even when you were a youngster.
Yeah, it's just they're like your best friends. You know, I always had animals in the house with me, and I just always wanted them near me. Even when my cat Blackjack went missing when I was real young, I rode my bike around town going door to door looking for her. It's just they're part of your family, and they're just played such a big role in my life, and I just love them. I love having them next to me. I love hugging them, cuddling with them. I just love animals.
Yeah. For sure. So if you would kind of trace the arc from a kid who loves animals and who still loves animals now, but from that kid who loves animals to private investigator, which, if I remember this correctly, early on at least, didn't have anything to do with animals initially when you were starting to work as a private eye, right?
Yeah, no. So, you know, when I was, I want to say like 21, 22, I saw Animal Cop on TV, like the New York Animal Cop. Mm-hmm. And I just thought they were so amazing. And, you know, I was always interested in animals. So I said, oh, I want to do that. I want to help animals and have the law behind me. And so I saw that all you needed was to have an associate's degree in criminal justice. So I said, well, I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to get my degree so I can do that. And so I did. I went back to school. I got my criminal justice degree. And then I ended up moving to Florida. They didn't have that in Florida. And by that point in life, you know, I just, that wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be an animal humane officer anymore. But I wanted to figure out a way to put animals and investigations together. But at that time, I just needed to, you know, start a career and start working and, you know, be able to bring in money, make money.
Pay the bills, yeah.
And so I became a PI, a private investigator, and I was interning as a private investigator when my neighbor's cat went missing, and she was my good friend. And so, you know, I was like, well, you know, I'll pay to hire these people I just found on Craigslist, because I was on Craigslist to see if somebody had found Honey, the cat. And I saw an ad, and it said, we're private investigators. We use tracking dogs to find lost cats, dogs, and gerbils. And I just thought that was the dumbest thing I'd ever seen. But at the same time, you know, I said, well, you know, I have to contact them. I have to see if this is a real thing. And so I contacted them, and a woman called me back, like, within 10 minutes and said she was on her way. She was putting the dogs in the truck, and they're coming from Boca. And, you know, this hero, so to speak, is going to come save the day. And then hours went by, and I called her back, and she had told me, oh, 95 is shut down. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you're in Boca. I'm in Fort Lauderdale. Go around, you know? But she said, well, I can't come today, so I'll come tomorrow at 9 a.m. And then the next day at 9 a.m., she called, said she's on her way, never showed up again. And then the third day said, I'm on my way, 9 a.m., never showed up. So, like, just, like, me and my friend were, like, you know, hysterically crying. This is so horrible. Like, how could you just somebody and give them all that hope and, like, you know, they're going to come find your missing pet and then never show up, you know? So that was a big deal. And then my friend, she did find her cat under the house next door from where we lived. And the cat was actually being held hostage by another cat. I know that sounds silly, but it's a true story. years later, we found out the cat's name was Bubba, and it was a neighborhood cat that a friend, another friend, was actually her cat that never wanted to come back in the house. So she said, okay, then you can stay outside. And that cat was sitting in front of my friend's cat under that house, in another room under the house. Like, she had to crawl under there into a crawl space room, get the other cat out of there, and then grabbed her cat. So that's how we got her back.
In a short summary there, there's a couple of kind of notable, if not wacky, things, including the cat that was holding the other cat hostage. But I want to come back to that, because one of the points that at least is implied there, which we'll get back into a bit later with some more specifics about people trying to find their missing pets and what you do and what other people can do before maybe even they call you all panicky, is that cats, if I'm not mistaken, tend to, when they are gone or missing, tend to be really, really close to home.
Sometimes. Okay. So I have a silly analogy that I compare, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is actually a great analogy for the situation with the cat Honey. I compare cats to drug dealers. Like, they are the same species.
Okay, before they were kidnappers, now they're drug dealers. I like this. These are my kind of cats, yeah.
You know, drug dealers don't let other drug dealers on their block to sell drugs. And cats don't let other cats hang out in their territory. So either you're going to be, you know, not be able to move. Like, that cat, Honey, was literally in the room, under the house, in a crawl space, and that cat sat there in front of her, so she couldn't move at all. It's either that's going to happen, or they're going to get pushed out of the area, because they're not allowed in that territory. So I've, in the last 600 cases, you know, I have learned a few things with cats, and it's a silly analogy, but it makes sense when you actually think about it.
Yeah, well, and again,
situation, yeah.
No, well, I was just going to say that given the experience you've had in the years of locating dogs and cats and other animals, which we'll also get into in a moment or two, but you know whereof you speak. I mean, you have the experience drawn, and you can see how in certain situations cats, mm-hmm. yeah, might be close to the house where they live and for these kinds of reasons might not be, even if they're trying to get back to the house. So one thing right. This made me think of, Jamie, as you were describing this, and this kind of goes back to when you were first working as a private eye, but it kind of pertains now. What drew you to working as a private eye? I mean, was it a certain kind of curiosity? Was it a penchant for solving kind of puzzles of one kind or another? What drew you?
Well, first off, the criminal justice part, that was the only major in college that I stayed awake for. I couldn't stay awake for computer science or anything else. I majored in a few different things, but that was the only major that I was actually interested in. So that was number one.
Okay.
And then my friend is a bail bondsman, and he wanted me to work for him. So I originally went to bail bondsman school before the PI stuff, and I was in the middle of my internship as a bail bondsman when I met a PI. And he was like, oh, why are you going to do bondsman work? He goes, you need to be a PI, because I was a good skip trace. Good skipper, so I can find anything, you know, people, animals, whatever. It was good at skip tracing and finding stuff.
Yeah.
And the PI wanted me to work with him, and that intrigued me. I was like, oh, well, forget being a bail bondsman. I don't want to do that. I want to be a PI. So that's how that started, and then I was with the state of Florida was actually helping me get into finding a career because of a reading disability that I had, which is a completely another story, but they were helping me with starting my own business, and I wanted to be a tracer of unclaimed property, which is finding money that's unclaimed. Really good at that, too. But to do that, you had to have your own private investigator investigation agency. So there were so many different ties to you know, the criminal justice part of everything, but it wasn't until, you know, my cat, I know I told you my cat was killed by two dogs in my apartment, you know, when I first moved to Florida 9 years ago, and that was the most frantic thing I ever in my life felt like I dealt with, and I couldn't help myself, and I couldn't help my cat, and when my friend's cat went missing, that franticness was there with her.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that there was a tie right there. And then I'm doing PI work for people, but now a whole other, you know, option or something that I've never even heard of came into play. Like, wait, people, there's dogs that find lost pets. There's people that find lost pets. And I just have to have a private investigator license to do that? Oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
So, you know,
bingo.
It kind of curved. Yeah. Yeah, that was what it was. It just curved everything. And I said, well, this person, now that, you know, I found this post on Craigslist, these people never showed up for 3 days. So is this real? Like, is this actually a real thing? Because if it is, I'm going to do it forever. That's how that happened.
So it seems like from what we established earlier in the conversation here, as a huge animal person, passionate about animals. So that coupled with you already had the PI training and license, and you obviously had a real kind of gift for finding things, which you've noted. So this all kind of came together, and so there you were suddenly doing investigative work and working directly sort of with or on behalf of animals. So probably the perfect fit.
Yeah, and it was just it literally was a light bulb that went off.
Yeah.
Well, now, if this is real, I'm going to do it forever.
Sure. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just joined us, my guest is Jamie Katz, a real-life full-time pet detective based in Fort Lauderdale. If you'd like to ask Jamie a question about pet detective work, ways to find your missing pet, or some other topic, or simply offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So once the light bulb went off, he said, well, hey, this all fits together beautifully for me. How long after that did tracking dogs enter the picture for you?
Oh, I mean, immediately. I went right to the guy that I was working for, the private investigator, and I told him, let's do this. I said, this is a real thing. We could do this. We could get tracking dogs. We could train somewhere. We could figure this out. And it went really quick from there. But, you know, I ended up you know, doing it a little bit in a different way, but it all came together very quickly. I think I still had I was still interning, because you have to intern for a whole year before you can actually get your PI license if you have your criminal justice major, which I had.
Okay.
And it's a two-year internship. So this all happened, you know, within that the year internship. So it was really quickly.
And so was he, if I read between the lines here, maybe not as interested in going the pet detective route, even though you were sort of proposing, like, here's what we would need to do, and here's what we could do once we had the dogs and did this?
I mean, there weren't many people that were, like, wanting to go that route. It was
okay.
It was a weird, out-of-the-box kind of, you know,
yeah.
lot of money to put into, and just how do you get trained? How does it work?
Right, a lot of uncertainty. It sounds like about
the state of Florida. They were the ones who actually jumped on board with me and really believed in me that we could do this together, because the unclaimed property business didn't work out. So they had my back the whole time, which was amazing too.
That's great.
But yeah.
Okay, so you peel off on your own, it sounds like, and say, well, hey, if no one's going to do this with me, I'm just going to do it. And then it sounds like pretty shortly thereafter, there were tracking dogs. So did you start with Fletcher and Gable? Were those the dogs from the get-go?
We were all trained together, yeah. I had three. I had one, her name was Kylie, but she didn't want to be a tracking dog. So I ended up finding her an amazing home, but she just didn't want to be. So yeah, just Fletcher and Gable and I.
How do you know a dog is like game to be a tracking dog, and then like the case of Tylee, like, hey, this isn't really for me? What? How do they evidence that?
Well, you know, there's the happy, the food motivated, and they have to want to do the work, and you know, get super excited to work, and they have to be smart, obviously. But Tylee, what happened with Tylee was we were on a case. Actually, it was a couple different cases, and they're all rescue dogs, but when Kylie came, she was really emaciated, underweight. She had a starvation problem, so she always wanted to eat food.
Mm.
So there was a little bit different than, you know, Fletcher and Gable, and I could just never get her out of wanting to eat everything. So we were tracking, and you know, she picked up a diaper a couple times in the middle of a track, and
yikes.
So that, you know, I couldn't get her out of, you know, is she tracking or is she looking for food?
Yeah.
So that was what happened with her. But Fletcher and Gable, they just, you know, immediately they just loved it. They're super smart dogs. They're just very focused. I mean, they're goofy as can be when they're not working, but when we're working, they're very focused and real excited to follow whatever sense is given to them.
And I guess, although the Tylee example, it's clear that some dogs just, either because they're food motivated or whatever their temperament might be, aren't probably cut out for this. It does seem like there's no particular breed that is more inclined to be a tracking dog than any other, since Fletcher and Gable themselves are quite different, right? What can you say what each of those dogs are?
Fletcher, I still don't know what Fletcher is. I mean, he looks like a little Minton Terrier mix. Mm-hmm. He's like 22 pounds.
Yeah.
He's completely, he's just a mix. And then Gable is actually a Brittany, Spaniel.
Yeah.
So, you know, they flush, retrieve, and point. So, but, you know, for lost animals, you never knew. But
yeah,
he loves it. So they both love it. They both are really good at, you know, building that perimeter and to tell us how far scent travels in each direction. So we have an idea of what's going on. And
yeah,
they don't have scent, you know, they'll tell you right away, this isn't what we're looking for. It's not here. So
wow.
They're real good.
So give us a sense then, like maybe a basic comparison of a case where you wouldn't use Fletcher and Gable and a case where you would. Like, in other words, what are the circumstances where you're working on something and do you right off the bat say the specifics call for help from Fletcher and Gable, or let's just see what we can do initially by this and this step, and then if we don't get anywhere, then we bring the dogs in? How do you make that determination?
Okay, so the first thing that I always tell everybody is that, you know, my dogs, at least, do not just walk up and just find them as an animal. It's not what we do. It's not the most realistic, you know, thought in the world. And I don't want people to think that, you know, my dogs are going to just walk up and find their missing pet. Because if they think that, and it doesn't happen, because it's not common for the way that we work, then there's a big letdown. And then they feel like there's no more hope.
Yeah.
So the way that I do this is, first, I tell you, the dogs aren't going to just walk up and find your pet, you know? And has it happened in the past? Yes, it's not common, and not when your animal has been missing for you know, a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a dog can get, you know, miles, a couple miles in 10 minutes, or even under that.
Yeah.
So it depends on the case. So if you call me and we go over your case and you have this super friendly dog, you know, you call, oh, my French bulldog is missing. He's super friendly. He goes up to anybody. He likes to bolt. He ran out the front door. Then your dog's going to get picked up right away. Like, that's just what's going to happen, you know? it's either it's going to get picked up right away or, you know, God forbid something happened. If that's the situation, that's the call that comes in, my first thing is not going to be, hey, you know, let's get tracking dogs and just go right out and find your dog. Because if your dog was already picked up by somebody and put into a vehicle and driven away, then we're just going to lose sense where he was picked up.
Yeah.
And most of my French bulldog cases that we've had, they get picked up so quickly, you know. So with super friendly dogs, I'm not going to suggest that we have dogs come out right away, because I don't think that's going to move your case forward. Now, if it's a situation where your French bulldog just went missing, he's super happy, friendly, and you got a phone call that he's at this person's house, you know, right down the street, but they're denying that they've ever seen him, that they didn't have him, they don't know what you're talking about, then, okay, then maybe track the dog in this situation, because you already have a lead, you already think that he could be at these people's house down the street. So, okay, you want to verify that we have sent going to this person's house. Okay, the dogs could help you with that, but you're going to fall into a situation where, yes, now we've confirmed the dog had sent from the person's house where the dog went missing to the house of where you think that your dog went to. But if your dog isn't there anymore, that's where we lose sense. So it's still going to come to, we need to gain awareness. We need to have an actual reward amount for this particular situation. Because if you already know somebody found your dog, the dog is not in this house anymore, and that we lose scent at their house because the animal was put into a vehicle and driven away, then it's going to be gaining awareness and somebody calling you because they want the reward. And it stinks. And I hate even having to say that that's the way that it works. But, you know, in South Florida, a lot of times, a lot of the cases are like this. They're denying having the dog. They've already given it away. So now we have to make the person who has the dog want to give this dog back, and that's going to be using a reward amount.
So it sounds like in those kind of scenarios, and unfortunately it sounds like quite commonly, that
yes,
people do have the missing dog, but they're sitting on it, or they're not just saying, hey, I saw the tag on your dog and I'm calling you, whatever, because they're looking for some dough. They're looking for a payout.
It could be that. So there's so many situations with that and so many different things it could be, but a lot of times it's because they've already given the dog away.
Yeah.
They don't have the dog anymore in their house, but
okay,
we still have scent, and the scent is still going to go to the house, so we can still confirm, yes, the dog was there, but can we confirm if the dog is inside the house if you knock on the door and you don't hear a bark? No.
Yeah.
You can't, because the police can't run through somebody's house. They're not going to run through somebody's house.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, you have a warrant to do that, and that's not going to happen because this is a missing pet, you know?
Right.
This is a lost dog. And even if it was a stolen dog, you know, unless the police say, hey, can we come in and look inside the house? And the person who lives, the owner of the house, says, yes, that's the only way that's going to happen. And, you know, I've only had that happen a couple times. Actually, it just happened recently on the case where the person said, yeah, sure, come on in. And, you know, but it's hard because you're not going to know if the animal's in that house unless you're allowed to walk in every single room and look.
Yeah.
So
let me ask a sort of a side question, then I come back to just generally how you pursue these cases with or without the dogs.
Sure.
How often is it a mixed bag to use Fletcher and or Gable when trying to find missing cats? Or do you only use them for missing dogs?
Yeah, all the time. And we just had a missing cat case a few days ago where the cat is 16 years old. Her name's Peaches, and she went missing in Lake Worth, Boynton Beach area, Florida.
Mm.
And the owners of the cat got a sighting a couple days after the fact that this happened, but the cat was seen two houses south of where they live, and then the cat was seen at that house, and then the person who lived at that house started driving, and he was going to Publix, and yeah, he's driving on the road, there's a car behind this guy, and just, you know, she's just watching the road, driving, and all of a sudden, she saw an orange cat fall out of his engine. The cat fell out of the engine and then bolted on Jog Road. So she ended up following the guy, because nobody knew he was going to Publix, obviously.
Yeah. But
she followed him until wherever he was going so that she could say, hey, do you have an orange cat? So he ended up going to Publix, which was almost a mile south of where this cat went missing from. And he says, no, I don't have an orange cat. And she said, well, I just saw a cat, an orange cat fall out of your engine, bolt it. So now, you know, now that we have this information, well, now we got to get some signs up because we need to be able to be able to jump ahead now, because this cat is now not missing from her house any longer. She's now missing from somewhere in between, you know, Jog Road and Public. So the situation gets a little bit, you know, more intricate, because now you have a displaced cat. So meaning the cat didn't go missing from his house.
Yeah.
But missing from a place she's never been.
Right.
So they can go further. So yeah, so we got the signs went up, and sightings are still coming in of, you know, they're eliminating different orange cats. They're reuniting cats with their family. One just was missing for 2 months. They just reunited as they're looking for their own cat with another family. And we did bring the dogs in, and Fletcher took us south of the home, and then he turned himself around and ended up going right to the exit of this neighborhood to Jog Road, and then went straight once across the street as if he was now following, you know, where the cat possibly fell out of the engine, and then, you know, kept going south and then went east into La Chalet, into a neighborhood, into this big golf course area. So our perimeter just got so much bigger than it was.
Yeah.
So definitely we use, you know, tracking dogs for all different kinds of cases. But I usually like to start with the off-location awareness campaign, which is going to be the sign so that we can get sightings to jump our cases ahead. So this way it actually is much quicker, you know, to be able to get the signs up and to get the information, rather than having to wait to have tracking dogs make that perimeter, see how far scent goes in each direction, and then get your signs up. If you have your signs up first, you're a step ahead.
Yeah. So two quick responses to that, or questions about that. One is, I get the example that you just kind of gave about Peaches and what Fletcher did. I guess I'm still wondering, like, let's say that a cat, I mean, some cats get along fine with dogs because they have them in the family, or they just don't, they're not bothered. But some, of course, cats are kind of flipped out by dogs. So right. Are there instances where, without knowing for sure how the cat would necessarily respond, and Fletcher or Gable are trying to help you locate that cat, there's any kind of weird thing where you know, the cat gets terrified because all of a sudden there's a dog sort of right, you know, on its...
Okay, so gotcha on that, understood. And there's two things with that. First off, my dogs are always on a line.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always behind them. They're never free off
yeah.
the line, and they're always very close to me.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, I do, my line does go out far enough, you know, but I have them, depending on that situation, they're going to be wrapped up real tight if I think that there's a situation of where we're actually close to the cat. So I'll give you an example. We have an example is going to be, I had a call where a cat was missing, I believe it was like Pembroke Pines or Weston. And they had seen the cat the night before on their windowsill, like at 2 a.m. They saw the cat on their windowsill of their own house in the backyard. But when they went to go, the cat ran, okay? So we wanted to see, first off, was this their cat? Because you're talking 2 a.m. in the morning, it's dark, you know? And we wanted to check for scent. Let's see if this is their cat. And if we have scent, and if it is their cat, number one, we're going to have scent right there, and we're going to have maybe a trail away since the cat was in their yard, right?
Mm.
So Fletcher and Gable, both of them said, yes, this is the cat, because they wouldn't do anything if they didn't have scent of that particular animal that I give to them.
Sure.
And number two, we didn't leave their yard. They both dogs did the same thing and gave me a perimeter of their backyard, went to the front, and then both of them stopped tracking at the end of their driveway. That was the first time that I've ever had a case where my dogs didn't leave the person's property.
It's
yeah. a small property. And
wow.
I was like, well, geez, I was like, your cat has got to be
right here
in the yard. So yeah, at that point, the dogs go back in the truck. There's no reason to have my dogs out to scare your cat. Because that is all that's going to happen. We're going to scare your cat at this point.
For sure.
You know? So yeah. we already know we don't have a trail away, and your cat doesn't have the profile of of someone, you know, being able to close enough to it, just grab it and put it in a car and drive away. So I don't think it was that kind of situation. I think the cat was on their property and just hidden to the point where you could not see it. You just couldn't. Either it was in something, up something. But if we ended up about probably a week into it, you know, they had three traps up on their own property. They still weren't being able to trap their cats. And it had been a week, and they asked me, can we come out again? Because they think they have sighting in their neighborhood. And so, yeah, we went out again. And we actually had a turtle leave in their house this time, too, exactly where the sighting of where they had their cat was. And I said, we've got to get your traps back up, you know? Mm. Get your traps back up because your cat's here. Let's lure your cat back to the property, which is going to be, you know, tie in a piece of your own clothing to your ankle, like a sweaty T-shirt tied to your ankle, and walk that same path back and forth over and over and over so that you can lure your cat back home. And they got the traps back up, and we ended up trapping that cat, like, 2 days later.
Wow.
In their yard.
So it's about scent every which way, it sounds like, really, in some cases.
Yeah,
but
it's so individualized for situation. Like, it's never going to be the same thing for every single case.
Yeah.
But it's always going to be about gaining awareness. That's one thing that is always, you know, awareness is how you make it impossible for anybody to not know you have a missing pet, which is super important, and that's what the signs really, you know, signs social media really help with.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about signs, because even before I met you, I knew a little bit about, like, you know, you see things, especially like, you know, in front of the grocery store or wherever it is, and you think, okay, somebody took out a piece of notebook paper and scrawled on it with a, you know, a Sharpie or whatever. It's like, okay, I just don't know how effective that is. Now, I don't know what else you've done besides that. But I guess the point being, can you just sort of highlight what key things a sign should have for people who might be doing it on their own? The dog or the cat's been missing X amount of days, and they know they got to put up a sign somewhere. What should that sign look like? What elements should that sign contain to be really effective? Jamie? Uh-oh. Okay, so it looks like we might have lost Jamie for one sec, so we will get her right back with any luck. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. Okay, we have Jamie back. Sorry, Jamie, I don't know what happened. No, the call just...
No, my Bluetooth was dying, so I tried to get back to my phone.
Oh, okay. I got
gotcha. It just took me off.
Okay, so what I was asking, I don't know how much of this you heard before the call dropped out, but basically, in a nutshell, I was just asking about signs and what's an effective sign, what components of an effective sign, just because I think that's where so many people go wrong on their doing it privately.
Definitely. Right. So the first thing is you need people to be able to see your sign, why they're driving. Okay. A small flyer, and sometimes you can see a flyer on a pole, but you don't see what's on it. And if you can't see what's on that flyer, you know, 9 out of 10 times, you know, unless you're looking for those flyers, you're not going to pull over to look at the flyer. So it needs to be a big enough size that people can see. So my signs are going to be an 11x17. I always do the 5mm lamination because you need it to be thick. You need the sign to actually be able to stand up straight and not, you know, curl back or fold back. And it needs to be weatherproof. So that's your 5mm lamination is going to make it weatherproof. You know, I have people staple them to the actual wooden stake. And then, you know, you want to zip tie them up at eye level. Depending on, you know, code enforcement, there's always problems with that. Signs might be removed, but, you know, call code, beg them to have them up, reassure them that you're going to take them down, you know, but you need to find your animal. But back to what's important. The photo of your animal is very important. So if you have just a cute photo of your dog, you know, laying down on the bed, nobody's going to be able to see what your dog looks like. So you need to have a photo of your cat or your dog standing on all fours on that sign. And the picture needs to take up most of that sign, and then your phone number very big at the bottom. And then depending on, you know, you have a shy or friendly animal, it's going to be either the reward, just the word, or an actual reward amount. You know, so that's your sign, big picture of your animal standing on all fours so people can see what is missing while they're driving.
So does, if I follow you then, does every sign have to suggest, if not state, that there is a reward? Otherwise it won't be effective? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, So for cats, I do like to put an actual reward amount for cats. And the reason I do that is because, number one, there's so many cats. And if you know, when you're out driving around or you're walking around, you see cats all the time. But do you think, oh, my God, this is a missing cat, or this belongs to somebody else, or this is just being let out to use the bathroom, or anything? You don't think about it because there's so many cats.
Yeah.
So if you have an actual reward amount on the top of your sign for your cat, then a lot of times you get a lot more sightings because people are more in it. Even in the end, if they don't want the money, they know how much more serious the situation is because there's that reward amount. You can imagine what you can do with that money, and it is helpful for cats. Now, if you're in a really good neighborhood where, you know, people are really animal friendly, then I don't think you need that, you know, reward amount for the cat on there.
I see.
If people are going to call you no matter what, then you don't need to, you know?
Right.
Now, if you have a super friendly dog, yes, you need a reward amount. Because when people find super friendly dogs, you know, sometimes they get emotionally attached very quickly. Now, if your dog has a collar on with its name and its phone number and you're still not getting that phone call, well, yes, you need an actual reward amount on the sign. So, again, that person wants to give your dog back because they want that money.
Yeah.
Now, in the end, they may not take it, but that's fine. But you have to be able to, you know, put that amount on there and also know that you're willing to give that amount, because you don't want to put an amount on the sign and then not follow through, because then you might have more problems. Now, for a shy dog, okay, if I know my dog's not going to go up to anybody, you don't put a reward amount on that dog, except for one instance, but I'll tell you this first. If you have a shy dog that's going to run from people, if you put that reward amount on that sign, people are going to chase your dog more than they're going to already. People are going to chase the animals no matter what. If they see a sign and they see the animal, they're going to. But if there's an actual a reward amount on that dog, they're going to get chased more. That's how it is. So if you know your dog's not going to go to anybody, you just want the word reward. You know, that way it's a little bit not as intense as it would be if you see a $2,000 reward.
Right.
So you don't want your dog to get chased into the road and get hit. You don't want your dog to get chased further away.
Sure.
All of that, you know?
Yeah.
Now, for a dog that's in an area where, you know, and I'm saying this in the nicest way possible, if you're in a lower income area and there's a lot of people that just let their animals outside, or there's a lot of animals roaming in that area, then you might need an actual reward amount on the shy dog sign, because people might not pay attention at all. You know, there is an actual reward amount involved. And like I said, I'm saying that in the nicest way possible, but
sure,
it's the truth. It has helped our cases where, well, we have signs everywhere, and when they ask the people, hey, have you seen this dog? They say yes, but they didn't call. Well, why didn't you call?
Yeah.
You know? So once we put the reward amount on, this one case that we had, it literally was in a couple of days, the guy chased the dog down and actually was able to catch it, and he got money.
Okay.
And that's what it took to change that case.
Sure. So, Jamie, we have just literally about a minute or so left, so I'm just going to ask you a couple of quick questions for just a quick answer if possible.
Sure.
So one is, what's the longest period a pet was missing when someone contacted you and you still found that missing animal?
Oh, so I had I don't know how old she actually is, but I want to say probably in her 70s, contacted me. Her dog was missing for, at this point, I want to say 64 days. She hired me on day 64. She had not seen her dog for 64 days. And then within 1 week, and this is only from the awareness campaign, which is I was not on location.
Yeah.
So it was from 100 signs that went up, no reward amount. I got her in front of her dog on, I want to say, day 72.
Wow.
So within within a week of having the signs up, she got in front of her dog, but her dog ran from her. Her dog ran a few different times. So it took a while, but we got her dog back on day 99.
Wow, what a story. Okay, and lastly...
That was cool.
Yeah, and lastly, we're just almost out of time entirely here, but besides cats and dogs, what are some other animals you've located over the years?
Well, we've had a couple tortoise cases.
Okay.
We've had a couple bird cases.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. All right, so Jamie, we've been speaking with Jamie Katz, the actual pet detective, as you've probably gathered if you heard most of the interview. So there's a few different ways if you want to find out more. One of the website is jamiekatzpetdetective.com, and she's also all over social media. Just search for Jamie Katz, and you can find her. And if you need help with one of your animals or just want to follow up some questions, I'm sure she'll be happy to respond. So, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us once again on Talking Animals. And
thanks, Duncan.
All right, appreciate it. Take care.
Have a great one. Bye.
You too. Thanks. Bye. In a moment, I'll play back my interview with 12-year-old Austin Testa about Every Bark Counts, the organization he created some years ago to help animal shelters, rescues, and individual animals. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner. We'll be playing a piece by Talking Animals fave Joe Zimmerman, exploring various aspects of crows. This piece is called, appropriately enough, Crows. Though by the end, you may want to call him Crow Zimmerman. In today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I had a Google right now. I had an important question to ask, and I remember typing in, what is my... Before I could finish, the thing that Google suggested was spirit animal? And I was like, yeah, what is it? Because you see other people and you know, right? You're like, toucan. But nobody's ever told me mine, so I'm genuinely taking this online spirit animal quiz, hoping I'm a chocolate lab. I don't know if I've ever been more disappointed than to learn I'm a crow. I thought these were supposed to be fun. Congrats, you're the scavenger bird. You're defensive. You're defensive. The crow likes laughing and eating. Everybody likes laughing and eating. It's almost like these internet quizzes are just making stuff up. I was aggravated, like a crow would be. So I went back to Google, looked up second opinion online spirit animal quiz. Like, no way I'm a crow twice. This time I'm basically lying, trying to get chocolate lab. Like, love snuggling and being rescued. Come on. Quiz number two told me I'm a cricket. That's not even an animal, that's an insect. I don't want a spirit bug. So now crow's starting to sound pretty good. Now I'm researching more about crows to learn a little bit more about my people. Typing into Google, are crows cool? And
crows are cool, and that was part of a piece by Joe Zimmerman called Crows, taken from an appearance he did a while back on Conan. So that was Joe Zimmerman with Crows, or part of a piece called Crows, in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals. Right now, though, we're going to hear the interview I recorded last night with Austin Testa, who couldn't speak live on the show because as a 12-year-old, he has the nerve to be in school at this time of day. But as an animal advocate, he's 12 going on 30, as I think you'll hear shortly. This is Austin Testa on Talking Animals on WMNF. Talking Animals, Austin Testa. Thanks for joining us, Austin.
My pleasure.
At the beginning, what made you decide to help animals?
Well, when I did donate the blankets from when I felt like the animals needed it, when I started donating them, I saw the animals and they looked sad because of them, like just sitting there with no one to play with them or anything. Thought that the animals would need like someone to get them a home and help them.
Right.
So then from that day on, I thought about the animals don't deserve to be just sitting here in a cage for who knows how long.
Yeah, I mean, at shelters and rescue situations.
Yeah.
So that really struck you, I guess, the day that was it a cold? It was a cold day. Is that what you mean about the blankets?
Yeah.
And then you just thought, hey, a lot of these days, whether they're cold or not, are not so great for these animals stuck here by themselves. Is that kind of what the thinking was?
Yeah.
So how did you then decide that, hey, a good way to help the animals was by raising money? How did you come up with that idea?
It was kind of me and my mom, because my mom had a commercial cotton candy and popcorn machine.
Okay.
So I thought in my head, well, couldn't we go to, like, fundraisers and we could sell cotton candy and popcorn?
Sure.
And then all the money could go to the animals, so we could buy, like, food and, supplies for the animals.
That's great. So was that the beginning, then, of Every Bark Counts, those initial fundraising ideas?
Yeah.
But how did it work? Did it, at some point... Was there, as I understand it, there was a GoFundMe page, right? When did you create that?
So, once I was at one of my fundraisers, and people were walking by and looking at my stand, and I, like, people that would stop, I would talk to them. So, this guy stopped and asked me, how do you know that money is going to the animals? So, then he started talking to me about GoFundMe, and I could use that, so, because you could use that as getting money for the animals. Right. So, then I talked to my mom about it, and then people could donate if they were, like, in, like, North Carolina or something.
Right. So wherever they were, they could donate. Plus, like the man had kind of raised with you, if they did donate, they could always be sure that the money would definitely go to the animals.
Yes.
That's great. So tell me a little bit about the shelters and rescues you've helped with that money that you've raised over these years.
Well, some of the shelters and rescues, one of them was Pasco, because I don't really, like, I stay in Florida, but I'm, like, nationwide with, like, sending supplies to shelters. Like, once I actually helped a horse, and I rescued it, and it from Oklahoma, and I brought it down to Florida, and now, well, a shelter did have it from, and the horse had its baby, and they were like, maybe 1 or 2 hours from being killed. So then, from that, it lives in Brooksville now, but, like, I just donate to shelters and all that, like, sometimes I donate from shipping it or from Chewy's will sponsor me or, like, by myself.
I see. Yeah, because the horse story reminds me that some of the things I've seen that you've done, sometimes there is, like, an individual animal. It seems like you help rescues and shelters, which is great. But sometimes it seems like there's an individual animal, especially one that might otherwise be about maybe in a position to be euthanized for one reason or another, and you step in and really help rescue that animal, whatever they need or whatever the situation was where the shelter or whoever was thinking they might euthanize that animal. It seems like you particularly step in those situations. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do.
That's great. So what's next for Every Bark Counts? I mean, you've already been running this for a few years now, and what would you like to do with the organization? Would you like to expand who it can help, for example, or make some other changes, or what do you think in the future?
Soon I really want, like, to get my own shelter for the animals. So that will be for adoption, but they'll also feel like they're at a home already.
Yeah.
So that's what I really want to do soon. But, like, if they don't get adopted, they would never be homeless again.
Right. No, that's great.
Actually in a, like, home.
So it sounds like one way or the other, you want to kind of keep doing this sort of work and just kind of keep going, helping animals in whatever way that you can, right? That's sort of, it sounds like your ongoing goal, even as you get older and get sort of
I planned on actually having the shelter since I'm 12 right now, since before I'm 13 actually.
Wow. Okay, so this is going to happen very soon. That's great.
Yeah.
And something tells me you're going to be working with animals and helping animals for your life, even after you're a teenager and after you're doing college. It sounds like you're always going to have a real soft spot and a real mission to help animals. So that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Austin, for speaking with us on Talking Animals, and thanks for all your good work already on behalf of all these shelters and rescues and individual animals. And again, your organization is Every Bark Counts.
Actually, before you go, I wanted to talk about one of my dogs actually trying to get a home now. His name's Bert. He's a 2-year-old bully. Well, he's a 2-year-old bully mix.
Okay.
He's actually at a shelter that I donated once. I saved his life from almost an hour of going to be killed. So now we're trying to get him a home, and we're also working with trainers. So because he has a really bad habit of, like, jumping, and he's not really, like, he doesn't like animals much.
I see.
But like, we're trying to get him to be, like, learn manners and all that.
Okay.
But, yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much. That sounds like a really cool mission, and I hope you're able to help that dog, too. And, again, thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals and doing all your great work on through Every Bark Count.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, that was Austin Testa, and that's an example of why he is an effective, precocious pro. I was wrapping up the interview and thanking him, and he had in mind to put in an appeal for this dog, Bert, that he's trying to find a home for, so he forged right ahead. So obviously it won't be long before we're all working for Austin Testa. Anyways, hats off to him. Coming up at 11 on WNF is Rob Lurie with Radioactivity, extending this three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lay. Then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with Euro Radio, hosted by Paco Morales, flowing into Scott Elliott and Y'all Soul's edition of It's the Music, and all kinds of music continuing into the afternoon, the evening, and beyond. Meanwhile, as today's prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals shirt. Duncan Strauss, you are listening to Talking Animals, and we'll be a prize, that Talking Animals shirt, to the first person who calls in 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. So, can you name that animal tune? All right. Well, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to join me next Wednesday when my guest will be Zena Gooden of Old Friends Senior Dog Sanctuary, which, as the name suggests, provides a forever home, along with plenty of pampering to senior dogs who otherwise lacked a home. I invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast and links to social media and all kinds of stuff are there too, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, etc. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon Largo, Weeki Wachee and Beyond, NPR News headlines coming shortly, and then Rob Lurie.